Hello, I'm Brett Dillon, and this is The Movie Chronicles. In this episode, we'll investigate modes of transport in 1947. To this end, I give you the humble pushbike in England, the Ballad of the Battered Bicycle, from the Petroleum Film Bureau, music Ludwig Brav and actor Stanley Holloway. We open on a merry place, a fairground with a flashy pace, where a fairground barker starts his spiel, a drama of androgynous appeal. It concerns the miserable fate of a feisty boy who won't abate the punishment that he awoke upon his bike with silver spoke. His father brought the bike with cash, not intending for the lad to crash, but Henry did not the bike upkeep, finding the grimy work a bit too steep. He was a merry little fool who rode erratically, very cool. He had many a friendly spill and never, ever increased his skill. He flattened a vegetable stand, crossed an intersection, and murdered his bike under a bus, which made poor Henry sad and cuss. His sadness continued when the police dragged him before the magistrate chief for murder foul upon the bike. He was charged, the little tyke. The magistrate did lecture him, stern and firm, he was a crim. 2 years was he sentenced to walk the streets, his crime to chew. And later, when he's learnt the code of the land and of the road, he sallies forth on pushbike new, and I swear this tale is true. History internally combusted on January to February. The UK broke snowfall records for the entire 20th century. The transport routes were severely disrupted, and what passes for British civilization came to a standstill. February the 3rd, P.L. Prattis became the first African-American news correspondent allowed in the press gallery of the House of Representatives and Senate. There is so much wrong with the former attack on the freedom of the press, and I'm not even going to discuss it. In the parlance of the time, honky let a nigger look down on the corruption of the US government, knowing there was nothing the motherfucker could do about it. February the 7th, the South Pacific Commission, SPC, was founded. It included 22 nations tasked with climate change issues, disaster relief and risk management, control of fisheries, food security, education, gender equality, human rights, disease control, agriculture, forestry, land use, water resources, and youth employment. May the 14th, the end of the harsh weather in the UK led to extensive flooding. April the 1st, the Royal New Zealand Navy experienced a wave of non-violent mutinies. 20% of the RNZN staff were punished or discharged. There were two main issues: low wages compared to the other branches of the military, and no procedures to get complaints high enough up the ranks to get anything done. Down tools, brothers! April the 9th. Tornadoes raged through Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas in the USA, killing 184 people and injuring 970. God still hasn't finished visiting his wrath upon these meatheads. April the 16th, the term Cold War was coined by Bernard Baruch to describe the tensions between Russia and the USA. May the 22nd, President Truman of the USA signed an act that committed $400 million to Turkey and Greece to help fight the spread of communism, i.e. to entrench corporate rule in the US while presenting it as foreign policy. The act was pure window dressing theatricals. June the 5th, U.S. Secretary of State George Marshall outlined the Marshall Plan, an attempt to redistribute the U.S.'s war profits, in a speech at Harvard University. September the 18th, the National Security Act of 1947 came into effect and created the U.S. Air Force, the National Security Council, and the CIA. November the 16th, the UK began to withdraw troops from Palestine. November the 25th, the New Zealand Parliament ratified the Statute of Westminster and thus became independent of legislative control by the Parliament of the UK. For non-Kiwi listeners, I need to make two observations about this act. The UK had only theoretical control over New Zealand through the entire existence of this country. The UK could order what it liked about the country, but we were so far away they could never enforce it. Why did it take so long to ratify the statute? Short answer, Kiwis love to piss off Poms. Longer version, as we'd spent over 100 years ignoring the UK Parliament up to 1947, we were in no hurry to free the UK from its financial commitments to New Zealand. New Zealand took a practical approach to bike safety with Safe Cycling, New Zealand Film Unit. The film unit made this film as a matter of public interest, as an instructional film for children. It was shot in Palmerston North. A tsunami of children leave from school on their bikes. We follow three of them as they behave foolishly. They ride three abreast and hold up traffic. One gets bowled over by a car and an ambulance is called. This leads to the talking head police sergeant at his desk to tell us there were 200 bike accidents in 1946. Some even resulted in death. We then get introduced to the good boy. He maintains his bike and follows the rules, although, amusingly, the film points out the adults not following the rules. A car fails to give way to the bike. A pedestrian crosses the street without looking first. It would be nice to think these sequences were set up for the film, but the evidence seems to suggest otherwise. Our hero and his friends then go for a ride in the country. On a final note, see how the green of the traffic light doesn't register on the black and white film. Births arrived on a wing and a prayer. On. January the 8th, David Bowie, the British singer-songwriter and actor, who died in 2016. January the 24th, Warren Zevon, the US singer-songwriter, who died in 2003. February the 20th, Peter Strauss, the US actor. February the 28th, Stephanie Beecham, the British actor. April the 18th, James Woods, the US actor. June the 1st, Jonathan Pryce, the Welsh actor. July the 31st, Richard Griffith, the British actor who died in 2013. September the 14th, Sam Neill, the Irish New Zealand actor. October the 24th, Kevin Kline, the US actor. December the 7th, Wendy Padbury, the British actor. December the 29th, Ted Danson, the US actor. And now, let's get trackside for My Brother Talks to Horses. Director, Fred Zinnemann. Script, Morton Thompson. Director of Photography, Harold Rawson. Editor, George White, and music, Rudolph G. Kopp. Actors, Jackie Butch Jenkins, Peter Lawford, Beverly Tyler, Edward Arnold, Charles Ruggles, Spring Byington, King Baggett, Edgar Deering, Sarah Edwards, Jimmy Hunt, Teddy Infer, Charles Bates, and Gary Gray. Fresh from the success of Little Master Jim, 1946, Fred Zinnemann got the band of Jackie Butch Jenkins, Spring Byington, Charles Bates, and Gary Gray back together again to repeat the formula in My Brother Talks to Horses. The film was not the success hoped for, but has, over time, developed a fan following. Author Morton Thompson, whose book Joe, the Wounded Tennis Player, specifically the short story Louie, My Brother Who Talked to Horses, which formed the embryo for this film, was invited to a screening of the rough cut. Producer Samuel Marks witnessed what happened next. Without a word, Morton stood up, walked out of the screening room, and slammed the door. Samuel remarked, "Obviously, authors do not need the written word to show their unhappiness." Morton's unhappiness was a signal of things to come. His non-comment also indicates a key difficulty with the film. It's hard to identify what exactly went wrong. You have actor Peter Lawford being charming. The characters of the eccentric Penrose family you'd think would be audience favourites, and the scheming gamblers appear as a plot device in many Hollywood films. I think that was the problem. The audience of 1947 had seen all this many times before. Coming out of World War II, they were ready for a change, not a reversion to business as per pre-war. This is also why critical appraisal might have risen for the film in each following decade. Out of the specific context of its era, the film is allowed to stand alone and is found to have very solid legs. The focus of the tale is Louis Penrose. It is the early 19th century, 1909 to be precise, so there are many people about with opinions on horseflesh. Louis is the baby of an upper-class family who all have their eccentricities. One member, the boarder, Mr. Putty, memorably makes an edible beer bottle that ends up exploding beer all around the room. Louis claims he can talk to horses. And more importantly, they talk back to him, cheeky blighters. His favourite companion is the Bart, a racehorse. His trainer, Mr. Mordecai, does believe Louis can talk to the horse. Gamblers become interested in this phenomenon. The problem with gamblers in these early films is that they trust to neither luck nor statistics. I would refer you here to the work of Casanova. He was a gambler, but he preferred to play as the bank because the bank, statistically over time, never loses. In a subplot, Louis's older brother John has some romantic adventures trying to court Martha. Louis becomes sad when he learns the Bart might be sold. John borrows money from Mordecai and adds the money he has been saving for his wedding to buy the Bart, who dies in an accident in his next race. John now owes a huge sum of money. Louis is deathly ill. The matter is cleared up when Louis recovers. He and John go to the race course where Louis learns which horses are going to win. An important consideration is that the pacing of this film is off. Audiences were used to screwball comedy, and this film tries for a more leisurely, observational tone. It also upsets audience expectations with a tragedy in the final act. This is unexpected from a Hollywood comedy of this period, and in particular bad taste immediately after World War II. Director Fred Zinnemann was born on April the 29th, 1907, in Rzeszów, Austria-Hungary, and he died in 1997. Fred felt inspired to become a violinist until he entered the University of Vienna and switched to law. At the university, he became interested in film, especially film from the USA. He once recounted, "I was born and raised in Austria. When I was growing up, I wanted to be a musician, but fortunately, I discovered in time that I had no musical talent. Then I tried law, and I am not sorry I did, because it taught me a method of thinking." Also, since in Austria in those days, canon law was required for law students, I later found that very helpful in making films. Fred was able to convince his parents to let him study film in Paris, France. Fred studied for a year at the École Technique de Photographie et Cinématographie. On graduating, he became a cameraman in Berlin and then emigrated to Hollywood in the USA. In Berlin, Fred worked with rising talents Billy Wilder and Robert Sidmack and became noted for insisting on realism. It was the introduction of sound into European cinema that forced Fred to leave for the US. European cinema was unprepared for this new dimension to the cinema experience. Fred decided to move where there were greater opportunities. His family, who had remained behind, were subsequently wiped out in the Holocaust. Fred did not seem to have experienced any culture shock arriving in New York City. Rather, he later wrote, "I felt as though I had just left a continent of zombies and entered a place humming with incredible energy and power." He started out directing The Wave, a cultural protest film for Mexico, and then traveled to Hollywood with this naturalistic calling card. The quality of realism had an appeal to director Robert Flaherty, who was later to recall Fred was probably the greatest single influence on my work as a filmmaker. After a few years in Hollywood, all illusions had been beaten out of him. There is an apocryphal story of him sitting down with a studio executive. The executive asked Fred to list what he had done in his career. Fred replied, "Sure, you first." Through the 40s, he made films that didn't really appeal to movie executives, although they had enough commercial success to keep him employed. The 50s belonged to him, starting with The Men, 1950, starring Marlon Brando, and followed by High Noon, 1952. The hits kept on coming, reaching out of the zenith with The Sundowners. What followed was the effects of Hollywood hubris. Struggling against television, the studios overspent on a number of flops, and Fred's projects got caught up in the fallout. It wasn't until A Man for All Seasons, 1966, that he returned to form. This doesn't mean he had lost his disillusionment with Hollywood. By the 70s and the rise of the new Hollywood, he believed this marked the end of an era in picture making and the dawn of a new one, when lawyers and accountants began to replace showmen as head of the studios and when a handshake was a handshake no longer. He continued making hits until 1982, when he released his final film and announced his retirement because, I'm not saying it was a good picture, but there was a degree of viciousness in the reviews. The pleasure some people took in tearing down the film really hurt. Finally, he had had enough. He was to say, "I always think of myself as a Hollywood director, not only because I grew up in the American film industry, but also because I believe in making films that will please a mass audience, and not just in making films that express my own personality or ideas. I've always tried to offer an audience something positive in a film, and to entertain them as well." And, in giving advice to young directors, he said, "The three most important things about a film are the script. The script. The script." DOP Harold Rosen was born on April the 6th, 1895, in New York City, New York, USA, and he died in 1988. Harold started his career as an actor for Vitagraph in 1905. He quit acting to become an assistant director at Mark Dittenfass Studios and then moved to Famous Players in 1912. He became a DOP in 1915, working for Metro. World War I interrupted this career. Back from the war, he shopped himself around various studios before, in 1920, securing a contract with Mary Pickford to shoot films featuring her brother Jack. He went to MGM Studios, where his camera work displayed the talents of blonde bombshell Jean Harlow. He was briefly married to her. In 1935, he moved to England to work for Alexander Korda. He soon came back to the attention of Hollywood through his color photography. it found a method to flatten the vibrancy of the Technicolor process so it more closely resembled a natural palette. Actor Peter Lawford was born on September the 7th, 1923, in London, England, and he died in 1984. Peter spent his formative years in France, and then his parents fled with him to the USA because they had no desire to become married. Peter made his screen debut in 1931. MGM was the studio at this time, but they came to part company. Peter was later to explain, "Metro was really a star builder, no doubt about that. You were wrapped in cotton wool. I was encouraged to emulate Robert Taylor, who came to the studio every day of his life in a pinstriped suit and a pressed shirt with a pin through the collar. They were very high on pins through the collar." An arm injury prevented him from being drafted during World War II, and he used this to his advantage. Peter began to make his mark in Hollywood in 1942 through his performance in A Yank at Eton. The modern audience is better known as a member of Frank Sinatra's Rat Pack. Deaths were a debacle. On February the 12th, Sidney Toller, the US actor, born 1874. February the 20th, Henry Herbert, the British actor, born 1879. March the 15th, Arthur Machen, the British author, born 1863. April the 10th, John Ince, the US actor, born 1878. May the 17th, Seabiscuit, the US thoroughbred racehorse, born 1933. On the same day, George Forbes, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, born 1869. July the 15th, Brandon Hurst, the US actor, born 1866. September the 21st, Harry Carey, the US actor, born 1896. September the 26th, Hugh Lofting, the British author, born 1886. December the 4th, Margaret Butler, the New Zealand sculptor, born 1883. December the 9th, John Kelly, the US actor, born 1901. Next episode takes us through the sexual politics of 1967. It's a hard job, but somebody's got to stroke it. Purchase all of the Movie Chronicles series at an e-store near you, and become a Patreon or Buzzsprout supporter of this podcast so I can become pot-bellied. Until next time, remember, a person who says, "I don't know what pornography is, but I'll know it when I see it," is a fascist liar.